Coming up on this week's show, are classic games becoming endangered?
The crap games competition is on.
And we talk bringing Konami games to the West with Jeremy Blaustein.
And the Retro Hour podcast is brought to you each and every Friday with our wonderful mates at Bitmap Books. Now, one of their books, absolutely worth checking out and getting a reprint very soon, is A Guide to Japanese Role-Playing Games. Their biggest book to date, weighing in at over 650 pages. We'll tell you more about that in just a bit, but you can check out that and the rest of their retro gaming collection at bitmapbooks.com. Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 386. Your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
Me, Ravi Abbott.
And me, Joe Fox.
And a very warm welcome to the podcast that each and every Friday takes you on a nostalgic trip back to the classic age of video games and technology. Basically, if you're old enough to know what this sound means, this is a podcast for you.
You love that.
I wonder if Joe knows what that means.
Do you remember? Yeah, it's MSN, isn't it? But the nudge, that's there's annoying, the nudge as well. This is definitely your new gimmick. Is this three weeks in a row now? I mean, I'm enjoying it. I want to see how far you can take this.
Yeah, I'll run out of sounds eventually. But yeah, it's that's what we do on the podcast. So we take you back, bring back memories like that. And of course, video games are definitely a very big part of what this podcast does, even though we cover technology as well. And I think it's fair to say that we probably don't. I mean, we're probably a bit guilty of maybe not giving Japanese games quite as much coverage on this podcast, mainly because it's actually quite hard to get guests from Japan on the podcast because of, you know, language barriers and time differences as well. But today we're actually going to be going inside one of the biggest Japanese companies for video games, of course, the legendary Konami. Now, this is really interesting. Chat to Jeremy Blaustein, who is one of the guys who's responsible for bringing some of these legendary Konami titles over to the West.
Yeah, this is for me, it was a real eye-opening kind of like journey that he went on, and kind of like, for me, learning the trials and tribulations of bringing these games over to the West, even as recently as like, 10, 15, 20 years ago, because he had a really, really interesting career, kind of fell in to translation. And it was really interesting because he actually wanted to study Welsh and learn the Welsh language.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
It was a really, really interesting interview because I've not really like discovered and looked at this area. And it's very much, Joe's kind of specialist area, Metal Gear Solid and Silent Hill 2 and titles like that. But the kind of conversation about the cultural differences and how, it's not just a translation of a game. It's not kind of, just changing the words. You have to think of how to hit that Western audience and how to change it. And working with that relationship with the Japanese as well. It's a really interesting interview.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's a really good point you made. I kind of forgot about that because it was like you say, in the earlier games, because he kind of started his career in the 16-bit era. It was very, go be an advisor on this game. That's kind of how we started, like give advice on this game. And it kind of progressed into translating this game. But it was advice on, kind of like porting it, translating it to the West. And like you say, Ravi, those first kind of games, it would just be a text box, but it wouldn't make sense for the West, or the one-for-one translation wouldn't really make sense. So he would get to kind of make those decisions of like, okay, instead of saying that, we'll say this. And it's kind of wild to see that that wasn't that. He described the word for it in the interview, QA control, quality assurance, but for regional dialect assurance, I think he called it.
It didn't exist
when he started. And it's like you say, it's really eye-opening to see who kind of made those decisions and stuff. And all the way kind of like into the PlayStation era, it was still kind of happening because of, he did the translation for Castlevania Symphony of the Night, which is quite an infamous translation. And he kind of gives his view on why that kind of happened because of, I won't spoil it, but it was really interesting for me.
It's interesting. It's beyond All Your Base Are Belong to Us. Doing something like Metal Gear Solid. Mm-hmm. He talks about how, there's different politics between different countries and trying to kind of work out the approach of that and then having to explain to the guys, certain concepts and ideas and what's going to work in the West and not. And also working, in America, but then also working over in Japan as well. You get two total different cultures.
I think it's interesting that you mentioned that all your base are belong to us from Zero Wing, because famously in the 80s, there were some really bad video game translations, weren't there? Like Nintendo's Pro Wrestling was one, you know, where it's, I think it's a winner is you at the end, and Ikari Warriors was one as well. So, I mean, it is definitely interesting to hear about how these big Japanese companies suddenly decided that there was a need actually to employ someone to do it properly rather than just, because, I mean, you know, I imagine in the 80s, you know, these earlier games probably only had a team of like a couple of guys working on them at most. So, you know, by the time they grew to the level of Castlevania Symphony of the Night, that was like, what, mid-90s? Yeah, obviously bigger teams then as well. And obviously the West became a very viable market for them. So going to be interesting to hear from Jeremy about kind of how he approached that as well, and those cultural differences too. So he's going to be coming up on the podcast. Jeremy Blaustein, our special guest, in around half an hour from now. Now, before we do that, of course, we bring you up to speed on what's been happening in the world of retro gaming and technology from over the last week. And lots of big news stories to get our teeth stuck into this week. And this one is quite a shocking headline when you read it, that apparently a new study's revealed that 87% of classic games are already on the critically endangered list. So these are basically games that are at risk of going missing forever.
Yeah, this was kind of a bit of a head turner for me, because it's because of, you kind of cast your mind back, especially for me, like 10, 15 years ago, especially around Xbox 360, PS3 kind of like days, when a lot of games started to get remastered and re-released and, you know, digital versions, HD remasters and stuff like that. I remember thinking like, God, it's getting like Hollywood. Have they not got any original ideas? Like, this is ridiculous. Like, how many times are you going to remake or bring this game out again? How many times are you going to bring Paperboy out? How many times are you going to bring Resident Evil 4 out? But now reading this, but only 13% of American games at least are actually available still on the market in like some sort of digital or updated form. It's actually quite sad.
Yeah, I think you're right to mention America as well, because this is just a study.
It's just an American study, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting because there's game preservation and there's also copyright, and there's also stuff that's held within the companies.
Yeah.
So as you're saying, this is stuff that's available to actually get. So it's kind of like, have the companies decided to release some of these? You know, have they gone through their old history? There could be tons out there. And it's interesting because there's this huge, you know, archives of games and stuff being put up. And then there's also private collections. And it's the question, you know, are you breaking copyright law? I know certainly in the Amiga scene, a lot of the pirated titles have kind of survived. And even
the only ones, really.
Yeah, even when you get them, you know, they've still got the Cracktros on the front and stuff. And they've actually kind of survived because they've been spread through piracy. So yeah, it's an interesting debate. I'd love to see a worldwide study, of course. I don't know if maybe the Japanese culture would be different in preserving them or the European or British.
Yeah, I imagine the Japanese companies, especially like Capcom and Konami, they churn out a lot of these collections, you know, that you can still get on, you know, Xbox Series X, PS5, Steam and stuff like that. But, you know, EA aren't releasing classic Mega Drive games, you know, that they put out. You know, there's no like Urban Strike and Jungle Strike collection or anything like that. The only way to play those games is the original hardware. And it's interesting because in the article on time extension,
or emulation.
Or emulation, of course, which is what Ravi was touching on. But it's like, the quote here is, imagine trying to watch Titanic, but the only way to watch it would be on VHS, on a VHS player. And I guess that's to kind of like for non-gamers to understand. But it's true, you know, I'm sat with my Mega Drive collection to the left of me right now. You know, there's like 100 games there, and it's probably, you know, probably a fair handful what you can still get on the Xbox and stuff like that. But I bet the majority of them are just, they're dead now. The only way to play them is the original hardware. And it never really occurred to me. Does that make sense? Because with cinema,
yeah,
I think obviously I don't know the number. This is just speculation, but I imagine 13% of all films are still available to purchase in some way or another, digitally or physical.
Cinema and stuff's a bit different as well, because even like, I remember the BBC used to have this policy of, even with TV, you know, recording over the videos.
Well, those episodes of Doctor Who went missing.
So Doctor Who and Dad's Army and stuff was all kind of found random places. And it was the same with a lot of films as well. You know, film actually degrades as well. So I guess the life of the media is another thing. But the way this report is talking, it's talking about stuff that's on sale or that's available. So I guess, you know, these huge collections of ROMs that people have, which, you know, there's abandonware. That's what people say. But, you know, it is still kind of copyrighted material. So they wouldn't count in this one.
No, it's talking about legal routes.
Yeah, it's talking about the legal versions of them, not copyright, not emulation.
And the studies from the Video Game History Foundation and the that quote that you said then about the VHS tape of Titanic, that was from Kelsey Lewin, who you probably know from Metal Jesus' YouTube channel. She used to do quite a lot with him. Yeah, and she's basically saying that. I mean, some people have actually commented on this, and this is a great quote here, and it says, it's not really the equivalent of only being able to watch Titanic on VHS. It's more the equivalent of being able to watch Stop or My Mom Will Shoot by Sylvester Stallone. Because the big, I mean, you're always going to be able to get, you know, Pac-Man and Space Invaders on any platform, you know, or the amount of Sonic the Hedgehog 2 has come out on pretty much every console I've owned for the last four generations. So I think, you know, in terms of those big, very famous games, they're probably always going to be available. You know, something like a blockbuster like Titanic.
I'm just remembering the scene where his mum cleans the Uzi.
Yeah. I didn't think when I read that, I wouldn't mind watching that again, actually. But I bet it's not on Netflix. So that is probably a good comparison. But yeah, again, it's kind of, I do see both sides of the argument, but also from, you know, the company's perspective. You know, if I want to buy a copy of, like, you know, Uridium 2 or Z-Wolf, you know, some of my favorite Amiga games back then, you've got to think from their perspective, is it worth them putting that time and effort into upgrading them to run on modern hardware or re-releasing them? And a lot of them have got kind of rights issues, you know, it's different companies have bought other companies, and there's licenses that only last a certain amount of time. You know, we saw that with, you know, Outrun, you know, when the Ferrari license kind of expired, that, you know, Outrun 2 got took off the Xbox store.
Yeah,
that licensing reason.
Stuff like the music.
There's reasons why.
The music for Crazy Taxi and all of that kind of changes over time. And I guess it's, how much does a company care about it? You know, maybe they're...
And how many copies are they going to sell?
Yeah, you know, focused on new products or something, and they're not really bothered about their legacy.
But I think it is important that if a company is not bothered about the games that they brought out 30, 40 years ago, that they then allow fans to host them on, you know, ROMs, websites and archive.org and that kind of thing. Not the approach that Nintendo and, you know, increasingly Sega have had recently of kind of pulling them down, you know, games that are not available anywhere else. That kind of feels unfair then and against preserving software. I think if they're moving on, they're like, look, we don't earn money off this anymore. We don't care about it. Here you go, have it, have fun. You know, download it as many times as you want. That's fair enough. But I think, you know, expecting a company to kind of upload all its back catalogue and still make sure it runs and everything is probably asking a bit too much. But yeah, that's quite a shocking statistic. I wonder if that, you know, the 87%, if that includes a lot of kind of mobile games and stuff. And I think that's only going to get worse, isn't it? Because a lot of mobile games are only available on a store for a limited amount of time.
Flash and
a lot of
games and stuff like that as well.
Games that need to be online as well when the servers get shut down, you know, they're basically not playable anymore. So yeah, I think it's definitely going to be a bigger problem as we go forward over the next couple of years. So if you want to check out that study, quite an interesting read. I'll put that in our show notes at theretrohour.com or just check your podcast app. Now, this one is quite timely, Ravi, because when I was at your Amiga show that you put on in Nottingham a couple of weeks ago, I was chatting to our mate Steve from Retro Passion, because my Amiga 1200 has been behaving really weirdly over the last couple of weeks. So I can leave it on for, like, you know, 24 hours, have a demo running on it, it'll play flawlessly, no problem at all. Then I'll turn it off, leave it a couple of days, turn it back on, then it'll hang every 5 minutes, which is really bizarre. And I've had it recapped. You know, I've got a new accelerator in there and everything. I had an ATX PC power supply running it.
What, like kind of ATX converted to the Amiga power supply?
Yeah, like a PC power supply, yeah. So I've had that running it, which, you know, should have been powerful enough, but I've had that about 12, 13 years. And I think, you know, with a lot of kind of modern PC stuff, they're not really designed to last that long. So I was chatting to Steve and he said, well, it's probably the power supply. It's the only thing we could think of. So he actually loaned me one of his power supplies to test it out. It works, actually. My machine's been solid for about a week now, so I've paid him for that. But actually, that was the source of my problem, it seemed. The power supply. Now, the thing is, I mean, there are companies like Steve, you know, that are making new power supplies for the Amiga, but it is quite a limited market. And I think having really efficient, modern power supplies for our retro hardware, that is something that's really important, because really, that is probably one of the biggest points of failure, isn't it? I mean, I don't use many original power supplies now. The Commodore 64 was the first one I replaced, because if you've got the original power supply from the C64, they're so badly made. Oh,
all of those Commodore power supplies were badly made. Yeah. I think literally, I think they just like blasted it with glue.
And, epoxy.
Yeah, yeah. And I remember having some that, you know, you'd accidentally kick and then you'd reset your machine. And they're very heavy and they're huge as well. So I'm glad you've kind of looked into the world of new power supplies. One that I've been using on the Amiga is the Duo power supply, which is really tiny in form factor, and it supplies two Amigas off one little power supply, yeah, which is really cool.
That's one good thing as well, because I mean, I've got the same on my Mega Drive. I've got one plug that powers the Mega CD, 32X, and the Mega Drive itself, whereas, you know, back in the day, you needed three power supplies for that. Same with my Jaguar. I've got one that does the CD and the Jaguar itself. So I think, you know, that is definitely one technology that since the 80s and 90s, power supplies have come on a long way. So it's always nice to read about new products that are available, including a USB-C power supply that's coming out for the Amiga soon.
Yeah, this looks absolutely amazing. It's so small. It just looks fantastic. It clips into the back. It's USB-C. Now, I've been doing power for my Amiga laptop as well, and I know that I kind of have a battery management unit in there when I'm powering off the lithium batteries. And they're saying here it's got monitoring and protection, which is quite important, because you've got like lots of Amigas have different add-ons. They have a kind of different devices that are all kind of draining power in different ways. And it is a bit of a power hungry beast as well. But being able to use USB-C is great, because it's got like a small form factor. I don't know about you guys, but all of my stuff is USB-C at the moment. You know,
apart from my bloody iPhone, because Apple haven't changed yet.
Yeah, well, I think they're going to have to, actually. I think there's been a court ruling about that. But
EU law, I think. Yeah.
But this just makes it convenient. It makes it really small. These things, you know, you could fit them in your pocket. It doesn't look like it's going to be heavy at all. It's got.
Do you remember those power bricks on the Amiga back in the day? You could do bloody bench presses.
Oh, the Goliath one, which was blooming huge. Yeah, but this also enables MagSafe as well. So. You know, when it's the magnetic
Like on Macs.
USB-C. Yeah, so if you walk past the Amiga and you kind of hit the cable, the magnet would disconnect. And it means, you know, you're not ripping anything out of walls and stuff. I really like this idea. I think it's really small and compact. I'd love to see what the price is and when it comes out. And, you know, I DJ with the Amigas, and even having that dual power supply is great, but two little USB-C things, oh my God. And I also had a little thought about it. You know, those battery packs that you can get, I can run my MacBook off a battery pack through USB-C. So maybe this would be a solution to kind of running an Amiga in battery pack.
That'd be good for your Amiga laptop.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. And I didn't realize it was so small. So really, I'm looking at the diagrams of it on their website, which is retrousbpower.com. It is really just like a chunky USB stick, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, essentially. Yeah, it's got the switch on the back, and then you just put it in, and that's going to leave so much room and, you know, just desk space for me personally.
So I had it with my Commodore 64, God, probably about 10 years ago. I accidentally knocked the original power supply, you know, when I was using that, off the table. And there was no protection at all in those. So literally it fried the RAM on my machine.
Oh, when God.
It hit the ground. A power surge right through it, fried it. Looked like I got it repaired. And now I'm using, you know, more modern power solution on that. So I think it is often one thing that we overlook, isn't it? We all want to get, you know, the best display cables, and we'll buy, you know, remakes of controllers and new mice. But I think the power supply is really one of the most important aspects of your machine, isn't it? And keeping it healthy.
Yeah, and I kind of like that it's not a weird standard. Like, it's something that's been implemented everywhere. So, like, you know, if you had these for other devices, say the Spectrum or the C64, you know, you'd be able to use your cables that you're already using with other stuff. I think that's really important as well.
Yeah, so this is going to be available for the Amiga 500, 600 and 1200, and is expected in Q3 of 2023. So not long to wait now. So you want to read more about that, hopefully. Like you said, I mean, it looks quite a simplistic device. I'm hoping the price on it is not too much. Hopefully not too many components in there. So could be a nice little treat for your Amiga to keep it running for many more years. That's called the Power Shark. So I'll link that in our show notes as well. Now, this is very cool. A previous guest that we had on the podcast, and someone who's behind one of my all-time favorite games. You guys know that I'm a massive fan of Prince of Persia. You know, I still remember playing that when I was, God, about 12 years old, going to my auntie's house with my mum. I'm being a bit bored, and then a little wander around the house, went up in the attic, and my auntie's husband, or my uncle, I guess he would have been. So, yeah, he had like an old DOS machine.
I thought you were going to say he had a Prince of Persia costume and I dressed up and started jumping on the walls.
He wasn't that cool. But he was in a band, so he'd always be out at night playing bars and stuff around Manchester. So I wandered up into his studio and I saw like an old DOS PC. So I thought, I'll turn this on. Did a little like, you know, DIR/W, so it was on the hard disk. Saw a game called Prince. I thought, I wonder what that is. Played it. Got absolutely hooked on Prince of Persia that night. I was sat there for about 3 hours playing it. Then got it on my Amiga afterwards and still one of my all-time favourite games. And of course, before Prince of Persia, I mean, Prince of Persia was obviously praised for its, you know, that rotoscoping, the animation of the main character.
Yeah, kind of. Then, early motion capture tracing over Super 8 visuals with pencils. And, but it worked and it created that, you know, the kind of flow and realism of the characters.
That really fluid animation. And then other games like, you know, Flashback obviously used that technique afterwards as well. But before Prince of Persia, there was a game in 1984 called Karateka or Karateka. I've always said different pronunciations of that. I think we had Jordan on the podcast and he said Karateka. I'm pretty sure that's how he pronounced it. But I mean, that game was kind of the prototype of that Prince of Persia kind of animation, you know, the rotoscoping effect. And he made that on his Apple II when he was just a teenager. And he actually kept a lot of the stuff from back then because I think he based it on his brother doing karate. And I think his dad kind of posed in a gi, like, you know, used him for some of the characters as well in the game. And he released a book that he was nice enough to send me a copy of a couple of years ago. So it's a really interesting read. And great to see kind of how much from the game and the development he kept after all these years. So now to celebrate that, because obviously next year, 1984, Karateka is going to be 40 years old. So it's very cool to see this news. It just got announced yesterday at the time of recording this. There's going to be basically a playable kind of documentary celebration of Karateka that's coming out on modern platforms very soon. Now, this is by Digital Eclipse. Now, they were the team that were behind the Atari 50 compilation that came out last year. I don't know if you guys have played that. I've got it on the PS5.
No, I've not played that.
Yeah, it's so well done. It is literally like, you know, there's all sorts in there, you know, artwork from the games, documentation, some of the original development notes and diagrams, and then you can play the game as well. So by the looks of this, they're going to be giving it, basically they want to do a deluxe remastered version, but then also they're going to be doing all this extra stuff as well. That basically means it is a documentary of the history of the game, the development of it, that you can actually play alongside the game on your console.
I like that idea that they've packaged in four versions and they've also got a remaster in there. But then you've got the whole background and the kind of documentary and the, you know, talking about how the music was created and scored as well, and how it was very much a kind of family development. It looks really nice, this does.
Yeah, and there's going to be, you know, the original pencil tracings and the pixelated game characters in there too. There's going to be audio and video interviews with Jordan and his dad as well, and kind of other gaming industry legends, you know, talking about the game and the effect it had on them. There's a couple of podcasts on there as well talking about the music of the game, all the original design documents, excerpts from his journals back then. And there's going to be 14 playable games on it, the Apple II version, the Commodore, the Atari versions, but also, interestingly, some kind of beta versions as well that he submitted to Brodebund back in the day. And also there's going to be notes about the development from the prototype to the Gold Master as well. So I think anyone that's, you know, got an interest in that game and the history of gaming development, it's going to find this really interesting. Actually, I think this could be done with a lot more games.
Yeah, interestingly, it seems they're selling it on Steam as well. At the moment it's on wishlist, but on Steam. And this is a wicked idea, kind of packaging it all as one. Like, if you're a fan, this is going to be something essential, really.
Yeah, so I'm hoping that there'll be a Prince of Persia version of this as well, because I think even seeing those kind of previously unseen beaters and stuff, I think, is really interesting.
I'd love to see it for something like Lemmings as well, or Worms. That would be great.
Really, it's tracking the history of it in a real celebration when you get these. So, you know, we always see anniversaries coming around now more than ever, really. It feels like all our favourite games are suddenly turning 30 years old or whatever. So I think, it is a nice way to kind of celebrate their legacy. So I'd like to see more of that kind of thing. So if you want to wishlist that now, I'll link it up, and I'm sure it'll be out on, usual platforms on PS5 and PS4 and Xbox and all that as well. So looking forward to that. Now, something else that's getting a bit of love, and this one, though, is by a fan who loved the game Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Now, don't we all love that game? Definitely one of the best side-scrolling beat-em-ups, I think. But now there's going to be a version of it to a system that previously didn't get, the arcade version of this game. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles is coming to the Sega Master System.
Yeah, this has been turning a couple of heads, and like you say, who doesn't love the TMNT arcade game, let's be honest. But the original got ported to the NES, and then it sort of got ported to the SNES and the Mega Drive. We got Turtles in Time for the Super Nintendo, and we got Hyperstone Heist for the Mega Drive, which they were the arcade game, essentially. But yeah, the poor old Master System never got a port of Turtles, never got a Turtles game or anything like that until now. So homebrew coder Xfixium is porting it to the Master System, and he's saying, and you can see it when you watch the video, that it is actually a closer kind of port to the arcade version than the NES one ever was, because the Master System's actually got a bigger color palette. The arcade game was such a bright, vibrant game, and sometimes the NES can look a little bit washed out, but the Master System has those really solid, bright colors as well. So, you know, in terms of the visual style of it, looking closer to the arcade version, obviously great to see, you know, the Master System getting some love, because usually, you know, these kind of projects are usually for the Mega Drive and stuff like that. But like I say, kind of had its own version. But then they've also brought in Lewis the Sega Nerd, who's a musician, who's making the music for the game, porting the music for the game. I don't know if you guys have had a chance to have a listen to it, but I absolutely love the sound of this and the direction it's going in, because of it's definitely got the Master System and kind of Game Gear 8-bit, you know, well, it's using the hardware, so it's definitely going to sound like that, but it sounds very different to the arcade and the NES version, but I think it really, really suits it really well.
And I'm impressed by how well this matches the arcade version of the game. Because, you know, for an 8-bit system, I remember playing it on... because I was quite surprised it never came out originally on the Master System.
Yeah.
So I played it on the Commodore 64. We had a version of it on that when my brother had a 64 when I was a kid. And I remember that being good. I think it was quite an impressive port to the 64, but graphically, nowhere near the quality of this. I mean, you've even got all the animations at the beginning and the character profiles, you know, that list in the arcade. You got even the animation at the start, you know, the cityscape and things like that too. And I mean, looking at this at a glance, if you'd have told me this was a Mega Drive game, I'd have believed it.
Yeah.
This is jaw-droppingly good for the Master System.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, at the moment, from the videos I've seen, they've not got like all the sprites. They're not fighting each other. It's not like in a massive playable state, is it yet? But that's, you know, visually, it looks fantastic. You wouldn't question it, like you said. If somebody said, oh yeah, this is a Mega Drive, or it was a, you know, an early Mega Drive game, I'd have a guess and say it's better looking than like Altered Beast, maybe even Golden Axe as well, for the Mega Drive. It's the colour palette, I think, that's doing it for me. You know, it's got all these vibrant greens and purples and oranges, and the first level when you're escaping the hallway and the fire and stuff like that. I think there's even some kind of pseudo parallax scrolling in there as well.
Yeah, you got like the fire effect and stuff at the bottom.
And like that. And just kind of like the pixel graphics on it, you know, like the character selection screen, like you say, in the intro. It all looks absolutely fantastic. So I think this is going to be wicked when it's finally properly working and, you know, people are playing it on their Everdrives, on their, you know, on their Master Systems and stuff like that.
And that's a good thing if you've got an Everdrive for your Mega Drive as well, you can play
Master
System games on that you know, it's backwards compatible. Yeah, I'm looking, it is just literally about 1 minute 58, isn't it, of like the first level and the introduction. I was kind of watching along to see if, you know, when the boulder comes down the stairs, that was in there. But yeah, they haven't implemented that yet, but it'd be very cool. I mean, looking at how well they've done everything else, I'd be surprised if it was missing, because otherwise it looks like pretty much a one-for-one kind of port, doesn't it? You know, everything's kind of in there. So far, I mean, you're right, some of the characters, some of the sprites, kind of the heads cut off when they're walking.
Yeah.
And I imagine that's, you know, you'll obviously fix all that before the release.
Yeah, exactly. It's only 2-player. They haven't got the 4-player on there.
Yeah.
We can't ask for everything.
So, it looks very, very cool. No word of when it's going to be released yet. I imagine it's going to be, I imagine you'd have a problem selling it. So it'll probably be a free download when it comes out. But early in-work peek at the game. So if you want to check that out, I'll put that in our show notes as well. Now, we often talk about impressive video games and, you know, seeing stuff like Turtles on the Master System. That's always something that makes me think, wow, I didn't realize that system could do graphics that good. However, this one is the complete opposite of that. It is a challenge, and apparently this has been going on since the mid-90s, since 1996. People are trying their best to make the crappest Spectrum games that they can for an annual competition. Now, this is a really interesting idea. The annual crap games competition is on for 2023.
Yeah, this is quite interesting. I've always found the Spectrum games, they're always a bit quirky and there's always funny elements in it. So really cool to see that this is going on.
Yeah, now this has been running since 1996. Now, the name of it is the comp.sys.sinclair crap games contest. I imagine based on that name, it came from Usenet.
Yeah.
Because, you know, comp.sys would have been a Usenet group back in the day. And the idea is basically people get together. It was, this is now hosted by a guy called Jamie Bradbury from Hull. And he got involved in this 7 years ago and basically wanted to make his own game. And that's the thing, a lot of us are, you know, we want to mess around with stuff. And if you guys were the same, I used to play around with stuff like Shoot 'em Up Construction Kit and stuff like that and Amos. I was never very good at making games, but I think just being able to make a game and have people play it is quite interesting. But basically the idea of this is, so it was based on, remember that advanced lawnmower simulator prank from back in the day? Yeah. It was in Your Sinclair magazine. That was an April Fool's where they talked about, you know, this game that didn't exist and then actually came out on their cover tape the month after. And literally the object of that game is, I think you just press fire on your joystick and then the lawnmower went left to right and, you know, mowed the grass nicely. And there are a lot of games kind of, you know, where the concepts are a bit crap. You know, you think of stuff like Power Wash Simulator that I know Joe's a big fan of.
Yeah, well, also it stems from that like magazine culture as well. So yeah. With that, there were kind of a lot of piss takey games. There was, you know, Sensible Train Spotting's one that I remember. Sim Brick was another one as well, which was a brick simulator. And people love that, but you're right, there is a whole modern game scene of it. I think something like Goat Simulator is really good. And also these hard to control games as well. Like, I don't know if you've played that Octodad. That one's an absolute nightmare at the moment. But people seem to kind of love the obscure or the strange, quirky kind of titles.
Yeah, and also there was that Cassette 50 compilation by Cascade that came out back in the day. There's 50 games and they're all terrible on there as well. So that kind of inspired a lot of
Yeah, there was the Firebird one as well called Don't Buy This as well.
Yeah, that was, yeah. So that's the thing. Basically, the aim of this is to come up with the worst Spectrum game that you can. And interestingly, you've really got to try to make this bad because the person who makes the best game then loses the competition and has to host it next year. So really, you know, it is quite an effort to make sure that your game is terrible. And there's actually in this article on The Guardian that's covered this, they kind of talk about some of the entries in the past. There's one called Pear Shaped that was a maze game. We had to just collect as many pairs as possible. There was a crap football with a digitized Des Lynam character in there as well. There's also some ideas that just flat out can't work. Stuff like SimCity the Text Adventure or Blind Flight Simulator. There's another one as well. And there's that European Sandwich Hunt and Whack-A-Nun 2 are other games in this series. So this is open right now. And it sounds an absolute giggle. And there is a website, which I'll link up in the show notes as well, if you want to kind of read more about the history of the crap games competition and some of the highlights of the last 25 years or so this has been running. But yeah, what a funny idea. And I think you're right, Ravi. It's just kind of that British sense of humour that it ties into quite well. So, yeah, very quirky and very fun. So thank you to Gareth for telling us about that on our Discord server. And just a reminder, actually, that we are on Discord. You know, we're chatting away most of the week in there. And we have a little channel in there as well that is dedicated to news stories. So if you spot any things, you know, around the interwebs over the week and you think, actually, that'd be good for the guys to talk about, please feel free to hop onto our Discord and post it in the channel. And hopefully we'll talk about it on a future episode. Right then, our special guest, Jeremy Blaustein, coming up in just a moment, talking about bringing Konami games and lots more to the West. He'll be our special guest. Before we do that, let's give a massive thank you to our longest running sponsor of the Retro Hour podcast, and that is our wonderful mates at Bitmap Books. Now, I was hanging out with your dad, Ravi.
Oh, God. I'm in trouble now.
This is at Ravi's Amiga show, because your parents came along, didn't they?
Yeah, they came along to check it out, yeah.
And Bitmap Books had a stand there, and your dad was fawning all over the quality of the books. He couldn't believe how good they were. I was kind of stood there with him, you know, explaining kind of what they were and stuff as well. He was really impressed. And I think that's the thing. I mean, I've got a big collection of Bitmap Books books, and whenever like friends and family come over, if there's one on the coffee table, it will always be something that people pick up. Just because I think that they're just so beautiful, aren't they?
You're kind of drawn to it as well with the colours and some of the amazing screenshots that they have in there.
And one of their books, it's had a really good reception. In fact, I think they sold out because they're doing reprints of it at the moment. This is A Guide to Japanese Role-Playing Games. Now, this really opened my eyes as well, because I've got a copy of this. And I must admit, it wasn't really a genre that I was that familiar with. I know, Joe, you played a lot of the JRPGs back in the day. Still a genre that you love, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the history of it and kind of like that. It's going to sound really weird, but like the whimsicalness of JRPGs and the artwork of it. It's just beautiful. And to kind of see that like Dungeons and Dragons-esque artwork, but from the, you know, the east side of the world, I really love it. And kind of like those like manga and anime elements to it. I think this captures it really, really beautifully with, you know, with game box art, which is obviously being presented really beautifully in the book here.
Yeah, and it reviews games as well. And it covers the entire history of JRPGs from 1982 to 2020. And it's got, you know, games like Fire Emblem, roguelikes like Mystery Dungeon, the first-person dungeon crawlers like Etrian Odyssey's in here too. And there's articles on the genre, the music, the art as well. And this is a massive book. It's actually 652 pages in length, 370,000 words. And it's got contributions from fans, journalists as well. Really, this is designed to be the ultimate coffee table book on Japanese role-playing games. And like you said, I mean, the artwork in here is just absolutely gorgeous. You know, really, they put it on really nice paper. I think it's called lithographic paper, the bitmap books you use. So really, the images pop and it gives them that, you know, the treatment that they really deserve. So if you're interested in the history of this incredible genre that really didn't get explored all that much, didn't get explored enough over here in the UK back in the day, this is definitely a worthwhile read. If you want a good book to read this summer, A Guide to Japanese Role-Playing Games, the reprints, you can order that right now and check out the rest of their retro gaming books as well. You know, support our sponsors, it helps the podcast out, and their website is bitmapbooks.com. And we thank Sam and the team from Bitmap Books for their continued support of our show. Now, speaking of supporting the podcast, little reminder that we do have a Patreon as well, you know, which you might think, oh, you know, supporting the guys on Patreon, that's fair enough, helps them keep the lights on and stuff. But we're not just take. We give back a hell of a lot, I think, don't we, guys?
We do. We are actually just about to record our, is it a 36th episode of the After Hours?
Yeah.
Straight after this, where we're going to be doing our top five overrated games.
Controversial.
A bit controversial, that one. I might get told off for a few of
I've got a feeling after some of mine, yeah, there might be a few patrons cancelling after it.
Yeah, hopefully not. Don't get any ideas.
We've banned Rise of the Robots.
We have banned Rise of the Robots. Absolutely banned Rise of the Robots. But yeah, no, we do try to give back as well. You know, we give an ad-free episode. We also put a few extra news articles in, usually two or three, every single week for our Patreons. Sometimes the episode comes out a couple of days early. And of course, my favourite part, every Patreon is welcome to our hangout, which we do usually the last weekend of every month, where we all just get together on a hangout, on Google Hangout, and we just chat like, you know, I was going to say absolute S-H-I-T, really. We just chat about everything, don't we?
Anything goes.
We don't just talk about retro games. We talk about technology. We talk about films. We talk about adverts. We talk about absolutely everything because we've all become friends on there and everybody is welcome. It's not like the slaughtered lamb. You come on and we go, oh, who's that joining? Everybody is welcome. You can come on. You can just watch. You can come on. You can show your games collection off. You can come on camera. You can come on and, you know, not come on camera, but still join in. Everybody is absolutely welcome. And yeah, we do that for about 2 hours, usually on a Sunday evening. We've been trying a few Fridays for some, you know, people across the world and stuff like that. But yeah, everybody's welcome to that who signs up as a patron. I absolutely love it.
Yes, if you want to join our wonderful patrons community, all the details are set up right now. And a very good time to do it if you want to get that access to all the back catalogue of the After Hours podcast for your gold member above and the newest episode. And get invited to the hangout that's coming up in 2 weeks. All the details are at theretrohour.com. Right, then next, our special guest talking about bringing Konami games to the West with this week's guest, Jeremy Blaustein. He's next on the Retro Hour podcast.
You're listening to The Retro Hour, and we're joined by our very special guest today, Jeremy Blaustein. How are you doing, Jeremy?
Hey, I'm doing great. Great to be here.
Good stuff. Thanks for coming on. So the first question we always ask all of our guests is if you could cast your memory back and think of what your earliest video game memory might have been.
Wow. Okay. That's the first time I think I've ever been asked that. So let me try to go back. It starts to get into the question. I'm so old. It starts to get into the question of what is a video game?
Yeah.
You know, there was a game called, I think it was called Tombstone. Very primitive, like side thing, two Yosemite Sam looking characters shooting each other.
Mm.
Drop dead. There was a game called Death Race, like 2000, I think. You run over these little moving, tiny little moving stick figures, and they turn into gravestones. There was a game called Seawolf. I remember where you look through a periscope and you shoot up a torpedo, just goes straight up. incredibly slow moving. Yeah, but then there was also at home before you know, before anything came out like Atari, I was playing those little Mattel football games. Football, it was just a small sliver of light that you would manipulate in four directions. And so in the case of American football, you'd be, you know, kind of just going up, right, up.
Yeah.
But hit, you know, jamming them very hard and fast, you know. And there was a basketball one, or, and then, the Odyssey came out. We got the Odyssey back in, probably it was maybe 76 or 77. Yeah. The Mattel Odyssey had three games, Pong, tennis, and I think it was like squash or something. You know, they were all almost identical.
So you grew up in, I read you grew up in Long Island. Was there much of a gaming scene around this point? Did the arcades kind of start to blow up? Were you a big fan of them?
Yeah, I was a big fan of them. And they did blow up then in the 70s. And, you know, when I first started going, there were older teenagers that would be playing the games. And it was always a little intimidating. It was a mixture of pinball and arcade games. And then, certain things like Space Invaders started coming out. And I would, let's see, how old was I when Space Invaders came out? Maybe 12, something like that. I'm not really sure, 12, 13.
Well, you also studied Japanese at university. I tried to learn Japanese once. It's really tough. Like, what made you decide to want to study the language?
Well, it was actually, it's kind of embarrassing to admit the reason for doing it. It wasn't, most of the people that were studying Japanese then, it was because of business, much like Chinese to now. Japan was really economically strong. But no, actually my first choice at the university was Welsh.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, and my motivation was simply that I wanted to speak the most unusual, you know, difficult, weird language because I thought it would be, you know, at least, I think I left high school feeling very much like kind of cookie-cutter-ish education and, you know, university seemed like an opportunity to get something strange in there that I knew would at least set me into an interesting direction. I didn't know what, you know, but the Welsh teacher, thank God, you know, I thank God to this day, she advised me against it strongly.
Welsh wasn't, Welsh wasn't that massively huge back then. Now there's stuff like, you know, they teach Welsh at schools and there's lots more Welsh language.
No Welsh video games yet.
Unfortunately.
And I don't think there's a lot of economic opportunity if you study Welsh.
Yeah, I think I know they've kind of reintroduced, obviously with us being England, not far from Wales, they've reintroduced that some TV channels are in Welsh and stuff like that in Wales again.
Yeah.
It was dying for a while there.
Like, outside of Wales, what are you going to do?
Yeah, exactly. So were you like, were you in the mindset of, right, I'm going to go to uni. I want to learn a different language, which is fantastic. I think that's amazing. And it's amazing the career you built out of it. But were you kind of like going in with like, okay, I'm going to learn a language and I'm going to get into video games. Was there ever kind of like a career aspiration or did that just happen? Did it?
No, it just happened. I started studying Japanese. The first year I wanted to study Japanese. My father wouldn't let me because he thought it was too wildly unrealistic as to be simply a waste of money. That the idea of learning Japanese was so ridiculous. And so I started my second year at uni. And so I graduated and tried to, you know, find a job. Didn't work out very well. Went to graduate school for a couple of years. after I left there, I wanted to get back to Japan. I was studying Japanese all those years, you know. I wasn't very good the first year in Japanese. It was tough, you know, really tough. Second year, I started to be like, maybe I can, you know, maybe I can do this.
Were you a big fan of like Japanese culture? Because I guess this was, I'm guessing this was a the mid 80s, kind of late 80s.
Yeah, this was, I mean, I graduated from the university in 85. So I was just talking about this the other day with my twin brother, as a matter of fact, with regards to the question, were we fans of Japanese stuff? We were tremendous fans. Mm. But the thing was that it's not like the anime, there were, you know, there weren't really any anime that we couldn't watch any anime. Yeah. What we were watching was Saturday morning cartoons. So we were watching Battle of the Planets and Kimba the White Lion and, you know, Speed Racer and Tobor the Eighth Man and things like that. And they were all Japanese cartoons. They were all Japanese. Mm. So, yeah, I was a big fan of it. But I don't think that as a kid I knew that they were Japanese.
Yeah. You know? I was the same. It was, you know, only the last couple of years that I realized that. Obviously, Transformers, the animation isn't Japanese, but Transformers as a toy, as a product, was Japanese. And it's amazing how much stuff you didn't realize kind of came from that, that culture in the 80s, which is really interesting.
Yeah. But this stuff was all, if we're talking about, we're talking about stuff that was came out originally in the early 60s. And then stretching through the 70s. So we were watching, you know, really different generations of things. And, it's also interesting, because it ties into the economics of the of Japanese development and stuff too. Animation was expensive to have done in America, you know, and so Japan after the war, you know, it was very low cost of labor. You know, it'd be like it would be like getting your animation done in, you know, Vietnam or Indonesia or something now, you know. And these things were picked up not because they were great, you know, nobody thought, oh, these are so great, the kids will love them. They were picked up by business guys, you know, they were picked up cheap and then they slammed together some kind of a localization. They did a localization, you know, and they did the voiceovers. And it was brilliant. Spider-Man cartoon from Japan, the first ones, you know, Fantastic Four, all of those.
Super Friends.
Yeah. Particularly, because I was thinking that I'm really in the same career as those guys, if you think about it, you know.
So let's get on to the video games. So, you know, how did that come about? So I'm you know, looking at your Moby Games, looking at your Wikipedia and stuff like that, and it's saying, you know, you started at Jellicoe and then moved to Konami. What's the story there then? So how did you kind of get into the industry? What's the story?
Yeah, I think that Jellicoe had a branch office in Chicago, and I was living in the Chicago suburbs. And they might have been a job, you know, job wanted. There might have been a job wanted ad that I replied to. I mean, I can't unimaginably primitive times. I mean, trying to get a job back then. I mean, you're talking about when I was trying to get a job back then, it'd be like you have to go, you print your resume and you literally bring your resume to different places, or you'd look in the yellow pages. You'd go to the library and get great big stacks of yellow pages, you know. And so anyway, I interviewed and I just was a lover of video games. And the boss of the place was this guy named Howie Rosenbaum. And he was the guy, he did the sound effects on Qbert.
I was wondering what you were doing then. Like what were you doing at then the company?
They gave me the position title of associate producer, but that just meant, you know, do whatever. My job duties were essentially, you know, the way it worked is that the games, there was a R&D in Japan, you know, and they were making, they would make games, but you know, the American audience and the European audience, they were really an afterthought. You know, these guys were making, you know, pixel, you know, 16-bit pixel, you know, art games, and they would let us know, okay, for the next fiscal year, in the first half of the next fiscal year, we've got, you know, this thing, which is a, you know, it's a monkey running around in an adventure, you know, and it's called this, and, you know, and we've got this, and of course, we've got Bases Loaded 3, and we've got, you know, Shatterhand, you know, they didn't call it Shatterhand. They would give us these things with these weird Japanese titles and say, what do you think? Which ones do you want to pick up? Which ones do you think you can sell in America? You know, and subsequently, you can make some requests for changes, graphical changes. And so we would have meetings. We'd talk about, like, what is this weird, you know, okay, so what is that thing? It's a monkey, you know, with a crown on its head, you know, holding a scepter. And so we wound up making, it was the very famous Chinese, what is that? It's appeared in so many games, this Chinese tale with the Monkey King.
Yeah, it's what. Yeah, I know which one you mean. It's what the Dragon Ball Z and all that's like loosely based on, isn't
it? Yeah. And so if I recall correctly, and this is a great sign of the times, this is a great story. So we would get this game, and it was, you know, I can't remember what it was called in Japanese, but Saren or something. And we looked at it, we're like, well, what is it? What story is it? We don't, you know, we have to apply something to, some paint to it so it will work in America, right?
Mm.
Work in the West. Someone came up with the idea that this guy, if we added a couple of pixels on his head, we could change the crown into a feather headdress, and we'll change the scepter in his hand to a tomahawk. And they called the game, this is the brilliant part, they called the game Wampum. Like
Wampum.
Right? Got it?
Because Wampum
is the double meaning, right?
So would you get sent, like, you know, when the games would come over, or the art and everything would all kind of come over for the localization, would you kind of get like a, this is what we want it to be, or a how-to?
No,
or is
it just... first of all, it would be wrong to call it a localization. You know, that word didn't come about for another like 10 years after that. Mm. There was no text, you know, it's just like, you know, a guy running around, bonk, 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 you know. Like, the localization was the change in the pixels and the giving of title and the box art.
So how did you move to Konami? What's the story there? Like, how did that develop?
Well, I was only a Jalico for 3 months because I got fired for being, you know, like an angry teenager. I got mad at my boss one time.
Yeah.
And he fired me on the spot. So so then it was just like, well, okay, how am I going to get back to Japan? I got to get back to Japan. I got to get out of here. I got to get back to Japan. And so, I don't know, maybe a year later or something, I got a gig teaching English in Japan. Mm-hmm. You know, anything was fine as long as I got back. So I taught English for a year. And then they didn't pick up my contract because half the students loved me, half of them hated me.
Right.
Half of them loved that I was passionate. The other half, like, were afraid of me because I, you know, I'd be like, and I talked too much, I spoke too much Japanese too. They didn't like that. So then I rushed, you know, like desperate. What am I going to do? By that time, my twin brother had been working at Konami in Chicago.
Okay.
Yeah. And so he spoke to a Japanese person that was there at the time. And I got an interview at Konami in Tokyo. And, you know, I tearfully told him how much I loved Konami games, you know, and Castlevania and such. I played it, you know. And,
yeah.
Yeah. So they took me in.
And what was the interview process like there, if you remember?
Yeah, I do remember. You know, it was like a classic. It was like you going to a, you know, a glass office room with a guy at a table, and a couple different people would come in and talk to you. And I remember the bucho, my eventual boss, came in. He was the last guy to interview me. And yeah, he was the one. I guess I moved him by my story of how much I loved video games.
Yeah.
I don't know. I was lucky. I was just super lucky. I mean, no ifs, ands, and buts about that.
What was the difference like then working for a Japanese company?
Yeah, great question. I'll tell you, I didn't get into the right division. I wanted to make video games, but I got hired by the international business division. And what they were doing was, they were doing the Japanese side of what I described before, which was we would send the games to America and Europe and say, what do you think? Which ones can you sell? What kind of, you know. Only now I was in Japan. But besides that, you know, I was wearing a suit and it was not in the same building as R&D. It was, it was on a floor with, you know, accounting and sales and the legal department. The president of the company was on the floor and it was very buttoned down. In the mornings we would do exercises and there would be an announcement. And so I didn't feel very close to the production of the games at first. And I was also doing like shipping. I was doing shipping numbers and stuff like that, really businessy stuff. And then, but the thing I was the only foreign employee there. There might have been some, you know, a few. I think there was a couple of Chinese people, but I was the only foreigner that spoke English. I guess I should say. And so eventually R&D would start to, be like, hey, what's this? Like, what's the Animaniacs? But I mean, at that point, there'd been so many, do Americans like, it started with, what do Americans like? Do Americans like this? Would they like this? And, I was the only one to be there, and I spoke good Japanese. Mm. So I got closer and closer to deal with R&D, and then they would, I would have to do really simple translations because there wasn't a lot of text back then. Mm. But I would write, I wrote the script for Batman and Robin, right? I wrote the script for Contra Hardcore or things like that. Did a couple of voice recording things. And then I oversaw the localization of Snatcher, which was the big one that got me into localization, really.
Yeah, that leads really nicely. So I was going to say, kind of what was your involvement in Hot Contra Hardcore, Spiker Mice from Mars, Sparkster, and stuff like that. So
those are small enough that I could do them, without much time. But Snatcher, they were porting it from, the
PC Engine.
PC. No, not the PC Engine. This Japanese hardware.
Oh, okay.
Name I can't recall. And then it went to the PC Engine. That's when Kojima wrote the third part of Snatcher. The MSX. It was the MSX. It was the original.
Yeah.
And then he did the PC Engine, which was a Japanese version. And then he added part 3. And that's the one that I played and said, well, we got to, bring this over. Because they brought me in one day at R&D and they said, what do you think about this? And I put on headphones and I sat down, for this five-hour experience. And I was so blown away because I had never played a CD-ROM game or anything with that kind of music or that kind of size of data or voice. So I was completely amazed. And the porting of it to the Sega CD, they had to redo all of the art. It was completely unusable because of dimensions or something, palettes or something. And so they made a special requisition to bring me over from the business department to R&D for, about two or three months. I can't recall.
I can imagine that you've seen some quite bad translations in your time as well.
Well, this wasn't one of them. Scott speaks perfect Japanese, and he's an old timer and speaks perfect Japanese, and he really applied himself to it really well. I added a lot of things. I added quite a lot of other text, and checked his work and made some tiny changes probably, but I also added a lot of Easter eggs, and I had to write all of the text for the Jordan computer and stuff like that. But Scott did it. The only thing I contributed besides overseeing that was the voice direction.
Was there did you work much with Hideo Kojima at this time then? Did you meet him? Because obviously this is one of his first kind of massive games, Snatcher was.
No, I didn't work with him particularly much. He wasn't involved in the porting over. He was in Kobe and we were in Tokyo. I would see him from time to time come into the office. And I would see him from time to time. But we never really worked together in any way, We met a few times, and I met before translating Metal Gear Solid with him a couple times, but he was never interested in any way. And at the time, he had no conception of anything outside of the Japanese audience, I would say.
Did you expect Snatcher? Obviously it's got its deep roots kind of into anime, and like you say, not much out of Japanese culture, but did you expect it to become such a cult classic? Because especially here in the UK, it's become such a sought after classic game.
No, I didn't. I mean, I expected to sell. I mean, we only sold like a couple thousand units, at most. Yeah. Nobody bought it, which was partially because of the Sega CD didn't sell well. But nevertheless, it didn't even sell as well as what was that horrible Sorority Girl.
Night Trap.
Then I guess I expected it would get Night Trap numbers.
Yeah.
But it did very, very poorly. And the magazines were kind to it, got good reviews. But no, I didn't expect it to achieve this level of cult status. Although, listening to those scenes, I mean, I think it's great. Like, the voice actors killed it. So, they killed it. And, it's it's a really fun game. It's one of my favorites.
Well, how did your role end up evolving when you started working on Metal Gear Solid?
Well, no. So the thing is that when I was at Snatcher, I was working at Konami. I was in Tokyo working for Konami. And I left Konami. I wasn't even there for, I wasn't even there for 2 years.
Okay.
Yeah. It felt like much, it felt like 5 years at least. But no, so I returned back to the States, and the first game I translated as a freelancer for Konami was, it was Vandal Hearts. And then second, I think, was Castlevania Symphony of the Night. And then I believe it was Snatcher. Metal Gear.
So just touching on Castlevania Symphony of the Night there, and, you know, some of the translations in that have become a bit infamous over the years. Opening scene with Dracula and Richter, can you shed some light on that at all, the translation kind of there? Was it a difficult process or...?
Yeah. No, you know, the thing I mostly these days try to tell people in order to make it understood why those choices were made. And I kind of alluded to it earlier, which was that I came from a background when, remember what I was saying at Jalico, how our job was to consider this game for this audience, right? So to me, it was always, I think that I conceived of them as separate pieces of work, you know, necessarily. I mean, in a way, you know, if you're making changes, it's a different thing. If you're putting it into English, it's a different thing. So to that extent, it's already a different thing. And so, and in an environment where there was no internet and there was no idea at all, if you told me that there would be tens of thousands of people who like look over old translations or, you know, that kind of thing, I wouldn't even understand what you're talking about. Like, it's completely inconceivable. So for me, the English, the US version was the US version, and that's the environment I came from. And so I never considered, especially in those early games, what will people say if they look at the Japanese and then look at this? And I don't think that, actually, I don't think that they should, you know, in a perfect world, I don't really think people should necessarily be poking around to that, you know, mess and then on Twitter, like, and making like semi-careers out of pointing out, you know, translation choices that were made of necessity in 30 seconds. When you're, you know, you're spending 30 hours to edit together a, you know, a hit piece on, you know, somebody's translation, for example, you know, it's out of scale. So anyway, so back to your question, Castlevania, that scene, when I got to the infamous line, you know, I must have had a playable version, because I say that because I was aware of the, I played the Japanese version. I know I did. So I play the Japanese version, and it's like you get to the first scene, and it's like a big scene. It's like Richter's meeting Dracula, you know, throws down that wine glass in that classic animation that, you know, it was even more, you know, sort of dramatic than seeing it, you know, as a new game, you know. And I read the Japanese, and I couldn't think of, you know, I'm trying to think of good English lines, really. I mean, in a way, my Japanese brain is reading the line in Japanese and absorbing, okay, it has this information, it has this feeling. But more likely than not, it's a line which is evocative of an earlier line. You know, when we read books, authors choose, you know, words and sentence structures in particular ways because it reverberates for us. But if you just translate something, it's not gonna, you know, it's just not gonna work. And so the line is just some kind of line like, we shall see the results of what happens by who dies, or, you know, something like that. And it's just like, I could not. And then he throws down a wine glass, you know, and to me it's like, it's just a crap line, and I couldn't think of any way to do something with it. And it seemed such an important, and, you know, and here's Dracula, and he's, you know, he's lived hundreds or thousands of years, you know, he's not going to just say some throwaway line. And so I decided I'll find a quotation. I'll find a great obscure quotation. And that's what set me. And I think they did a search for, you know, like in a quotation book, like they had, you know, humanity or man or something, you know, I looked up, you know, cause I was trying to find something deep, you know, and I stumbled on that line.
Yeah.
And I thought it captured his, you know, kind of like mocking in nature. And so then I used that. I tried to make the rest of his speech match that. character, you know.
So, you know, once you've done that, like the process of translating it, so you've had, you know, you've found that mantra, if you will, that quotation. Does that then go back, once you've put it in the game, does that then go back to approval to Konami, or is it just kind of like you have the you had the final say and it was done? Was that trust there, or was it just, or did it go back for quality?
Well, the simple answer is that I don't know. I don't know, but I can tell you what I suspect. I can tell you what I suspect was the way things were then and how things would be now. That's what I can tell you. So what I suspect was that there simply wasn't anyone to read over my text, of course.
Yeah.
No one would be qualified to do it, and it would take a long freaking time. Mm-hmm. And it would just be like, you know, it'd be questions everywhere. Mm-hmm. What does this word mean? What is this? Why do you use this? And so they have a schedule. So no, it was just passed right along. In those times, there was no LQA, which is linguistic quality assurance. Okay? But now it would be checked over many, many, many times in the cycle of my company, Dragon Data, for example, a game localization company located here in Osaka. Thank you very much for the opportunity. we check things over on multiple levels, and then this is before the translation is even submitted, and then after it's submitted, there's a process of LQA and QA, where game players play it with the text implemented into it. If there are bugs or strange issues, it goes back to us. We smooth it out. Sometimes when things are, I'll leave that for a different time. But yeah, that's generally what would have happened now. And so more likely than not, it just depends on the client. You know, some clients have people that understand that the text needs to be punched up, and some people don't understand it at all. And they actually will say to you, can you make this more like the Japanese? And we're like, okay, yeah, we'll make your text worse if you want.
Well, I was wondering, like in Metal Gear Solid as well, how did you approach like the huge range of subjects that they had, you know, nuclear technology,
it was hard.
International relations, all of that?
It was hard. I did a lot of research. I like to do research. I like that process a lot. So, Kojima-san, that's what he does. He does huge amounts of research in different fields. And as you know, he has characters speak on those subjects who are long periods of time. You have to kind of backtrack. It's difficult to follow in the heels of someone's research because, you know, you don't know exactly which strange trails that they went down. And when you're doing it in a different language, generally in the case of military technology, it is really hard because English would have a very specific term. You know, like the name would be in English, maybe, and the Japanese would be kind of a more basic, dumbed down version of the technical jargon of English. And so it was actually really hard to work backwards and figure out what the original, you know, because many of these things, there was no dictionaries that were talking about, you know, the technology of metal that changes, you know, dudes and temperature. But when I read about it, I knew Kojima must have sought it somewhere, you know. But these things were not easy to find. He was always trying to get really, really cutting edge stuff. And I was so nervous about getting it wrong. I mean, these things about like the different security levels in nuclear facilities. I knew Kojima was reading something, but it's not like he would just say, here's what I read. I never talked to him. So for a period of 6 months, I just did a lot of lurk.
Yeah. Maybe researching some of the things he might have researched, or some of the rabbit holes he might have gone down. But I guess you just don't know. You're just there in the office, just trying to make it as best as possible.
Exactly. You know, and the thing is, it's like, I also don't know what inspired him exactly. You know, he's dealing with, you know, Japanese cultural icons. Generally speaking, as an author writes what they know.
Yeah.
And if you look at the voice actors that he used, you can get kind of an idea of what his snake was.
Yeah.
Right. Well, what am I going to do? You know, I can't bring that to you. And he never said to me, you know, let's do Clint Eastwood. He wasn't going for Clint Eastwood. I was going for Clint Eastwood.
Yeah. You know? It's just, is it just a case of that's how you read the script and how you read the game? And who it's you a, kind of
it's
envisioned?
It's a combination of that and what I thought would work and what I thought, yeah. I mean, you know, you have to choose a voice when you write something. Your character can't be inconsistent from the beginning to the end. And so you start to get an image of that character, and then you simply have him speak in the way that you're imagining him, you know?
Yeah.
Now, I have a skeleton in Japanese, right? If it says, you know, if it says in Japanese, yes, I will do that, right? I still have to ask myself, well, how am I going to write the, you know, how would this character say, yes, I will do
that? So obviously Metal Gear, it was, we mentioned earlier on, Snatcher was kind of like the kind of beginnings of like cinematic storytelling and gaming. Metal Gear Solid was such a huge step in the industry, you know, we're 98, 99, and you know, the depth of the story. Were you pleased with, you know, the kind of end result and the translation and the feedback you got when it came to the West?
Yeah. First of all, I was still blown away by the game. I mean, I was psyched to translate this thing. It was very, very exciting. And was I pleased? Yeah, I was very pleased.
Was there many changes that needed to be made kind of for a Western audience? You know, was there anything you kind of had to like balance with translating the game, and anything you kind of had to maintain from the original meaning to a Western meaning, or was it quite relatable?
Well, I wouldn't say it was quite relatable. Parts of it were, parts of it were not. I mean,
yeah.
How am I going to find, you know, Psycho Mantis relatable, you know, no, it wasn't relatable, but I think I got the campiness of it, you know?
Yeah.
I think that, you know, like I said, I grew up watching Japanese cartoons, and I'm the same age as Kojima. So I always felt like I got him, you know? I never really felt like he was hard to get. Although, yeah, like I said before, it wasn't that the stuff was unfamiliar. You know, it's more like, take a Revolver Ocelot. Yeah. Well, think about this for a minute. This is the result of Kojima-san seeing, you know, I don't know, 60s spaghetti westerns or whatever, right?
Yeah.
But now he's watching it in Japanese with subtitles that, believe me, if you've read Japanese subtitles, they don't exactly flesh out a character. But it's got the meaning in there. So, you know, you can follow the story. But how that appealed to, how it entered Kojima's brain and mixed with other stuff, and I can't say. And then he's projecting it then out. He's trying to make a game which is evocative of this, and yet he's doing it for a Japanese audience. So, you know, you're playing with a lot of weird, you know, weirdness, you know? But what I'm trying to do is I saw it as, I think of it as a kind of a cultural sniff test hurdle, okay? What I mean by that is, if we're working within like a genre like spy, for example, you know, we have certain things, we've got James Bond, and we've got, you know, whatever, you name it, you know? Particularly in the world of like military stuff and war films and some like that, Americans have a rather high bar at this point, having been at war basically our entire history. And we watch a lot of it on TV, and it gets pretty technical, you know? So I would say Americans are much more literate in terms of the specifics of war. And so if you take a Japanese version, which is somewhat dulled down in the sense, I don't want to say dumbed down, I'll say dulled down, because it's not quite as, it's something like 20 years behind in terms of like its clichédness, you know?
Yeah.
You know, if you watch something from the 50s now, you'd be like, oh my God, they're such stiff wooden actors. Well, when I watch Japanese stuff that's trying to be Western, it's usually kind of like old and, you know, campy and like 10, 15 years behind.
Yeah, yeah.
So to me, it's not going to really pass the smell test that I felt Metal Gear Solid needed to pass for Snake to be a believable character, a believable military tough guy. And so I wanted to make him a badass, and I wanted to be really right, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
I think that, you know, a good localization, it can't make the game better, maybe, or maybe it can, maybe it can. But it can really ruin a game, I think.
Yeah, 100%. It can ruin a game, 100%. But I mean, the proof's in the pudding. You did an absolute fantastic job of it, and kind of really set, I guess, you know, the precedent and the roots for all of those characters that are still in games today and still being released today and remade and stuff like that. So can you tell us about your experience with the Silent Hill games and Silent Hill 2? You've gone on record before to say that Silent Hill 2 was actually one of your most fulfilling projects.
Absolutely. Silent Hill 2, again, it was probably around 99 or... But I would go over to meet with the team quite a lot. They were very open to, from the very beginning, they were really open to, before they'd even written anything, talking things over and eager to see how it might go over in America, because they weren't even, as you know, there's no Japanese voiceover for it.
Yeah.
So it was really always intended to be for foreign audiences.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. They had that quite in mind. And so Mr. Owaku was really, he was very eager that the translation be done well.
Mm.
And in order to do so, he read pretty good Japanese English, like many Japanese do. Couldn't speak it, but he could read it very well. And so I would translate the stuff, and he read over everything I did. And he would ask, you know, ask questions, you know, and I would ask him questions, you know, why is Jairus, you know, doing this here, or why does Mary feel this way, or doing it? And we would talk quite a lot. Mm-hmm. Sometimes he would say, you know, why do you write it this way? Could you do it more like this? And sometimes I'd say, well, the Japanese is like, we would never say that in this situation. And he would say, what would you say? And he would rewrite the Japanese, you know, if I made a good argument. So we had a lot of great back and forth. And in the end, we had like a complete movie-like script that was great.
That must have been really important, because there's quite a lot of like complex and quite dark ideas in Silent Hill.
Yeah, and that's why they were also, I think, very intelligent to keep me on board. And I arranged the auditions and the actors to come to the auditions, and together, maybe like four Japanese guys plus me, watch the auditions. I would run the actors through different, you know, scenes, and then we talked about which actors we liked, and then the then we did the motion capture, and while we did the motion capture, we videotaped it, because we I had already done a few voiceover jobs, and I was concerned about, normally when you do a game, you know, at best what you can do is you can watch on the monitor the characters talking, and you know, you kind of talk. It's called your overdubbing.
Yeah.
Actually, it's called automatic dialogue replacement, but not ADR. But the thing is, when we did the motion capture, you know, we've got all these guys running, you know, moving around, and they're doing these scenes. But I knew that we couldn't mic them up, obviously, in that environment. And so we would have to do the voiceover later. But I wanted the voiceover to be as seamlessly matching with the movements as possible. And so the idea we came up with was, I think it was my idea, actually, was to videotape us during the motion capture, so that then in the recording booth, we would show them the videotape of the motion capture, them speaking the lines. So they would just listen in one ear and then redo the lines the same way that they did it. So, because in the moment when you're acting, it's very different than when you're...
So you mentioned in there, obviously, like at this point, you know, there's the ADR rooms, and, you know, with late 90s, early 2000s, you've got motion capture, you know, recording it and everything like that. How's the process of game translation kind of changed over the years, you know, especially with like the newer technologies and the, you know, the advent of the internet and stuff like that?
Well, you know, it's an entire industry now. It's a giant, giant industry. At the time, the word localization didn't exist. So we were just, you know, well, now, you know, you're multi-million dollar industry companies, which only do game localization, you know. But for all that, very little has changed in a lot of ways. You know, the technology that you speak of, and these are computer-assisted translation tools that they store glossaries and they, you know, remind you, last time this was translated this way. And, you know, so they're very useful for those types of things. On the other hand, we're in a climate where things are very different in terms of, at least the most vocal fans appear to be asking for a different kind of translation. I personally, you know, think that translators do an amazing job. You know, they're completely dedicated to, I think, you know, they get a bad rap. Sometimes there's this talk of localizers and translators. I hate localizers, but I love translators. It's nonsense. Mm. It's nonsense. What people simply don't understand if they only speak one language is that you cannot write, you can't translate something and not change it. You are changing it. You know, people might poo-poo that and say, well, I just want to know what it says. But do you really? Do you really want your characters to? The place that I am going to go is to the adventure room where I will seek a treasure. Is that really what you want your characters to speak like? I don't think so. And then they're going to say, oh, no, now you're just making the, you know, ridiculous. But, you know, the point is these are artistic and judgments that need to be made in order to satisfy a lot of different hats. You've got to satisfy the meaning. You've got to satisfy the tone. You might have to make a joke. You might have to keep it a riddle. You might have to make, I don't know, fan service or, there's a joke that's in Japanese that doesn't work. So you actually have to make reference. A million different things, you know. But what it never is, or almost never, is a translator simply, you know, puffed up with pride trying to get their own message across. That's a bunch of bull, because if there is anyone doing that, they certainly don't work for me, and I haven't seen them. Because if you want to become a professional in the industry, obviously you have to do good work. It's a very competitive industry. A lot of people have become translators in the recent years, and now there's translators from Japanese to German and translates Japanese to Turkish, and those things didn't exist before, and it's because of video games.
Well, before you finish, can we talk about Dragon Baby as well? You're the president of that company.
Sure, yeah, I'd appreciate that. I founded Dragon Baby. It was right when Corona started, actually.
Okay.
It was in March of 2020. And since then, my co-founder, Sam Burton, has joined on, and we've got a very healthy and growing localization company going here in Osaka, Japan. We go from pretty much all language pairs, of which there are about 13 or 14 that they're doing into games these days. We like to do very creative, interesting games. If you look us up, maybe you can find a few of those. I don't want to go into too many examples, but yeah, it's, I've always been a game localizer, you know, since 91, I was doing this. And before that, I was watching localized Japanese cartoons. So, yeah, I'm very, very happy to be where I am now. And there's a whole new generation of translators of all these great Japanese creative works and not just Japanese, you know. My company also goes from Chinese into different languages, or Korean or German, or, you know, any language pairs. We've got people, creative people that love games that are working on them. So it's a great time for the industry. You know, that indie games have made it such that it's just such an open environment for creative people to be making games and for them to be reaching audiences digitally in ways that were completely impossible back when I was doing stuff in the industry. Yeah.
Wow. That's absolutely brilliant. And you know what? Very, very insightful, especially for me, and hopefully very insightful for our audience. You know, bit of a pioneer when it kind of comes to localization and translating there, and really, really eye-opening. So, what a fantastic interview. Thank you so much, Jeremy.
Thank you so much.